This is the Concealed Carry Podcast, episode number 89. Welcome to the Concealed Carry Podcast, part of the ConcealedCarry.com network. I am your host, Riley Bowman, and today I've got with me, as usual, Jacob Paulson.
Howdy.
Say hello.
Hola.
And Jacob and I are doing this remotely, and which we usually do, but I am not in Colorado, where I expected to be. So we'll see how this goes today. Today is our usual news episode, and we've got tons of really great stories. In fact, this will be kind of our first regular, like, standard news episode, and as we normally do. It'll be our first one we've had in some time, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
So it's been a crazy month. I mean, we had the holidays, we had SHOT Show, American Marksman, everything. So today, coming up in the news, we're going to talk about the shooting took place at the Fort Lauderdale Airport, background checks in Nevada, how many guns the TSA is catching every day, crazy stuff there, national reciprocity, big contracts being awarded in the U.S. Army, and we have several really great justified stories coming up today. So hope that you'll stay tuned for all of that. Don't want you to miss any of it. And today we are going to skip the training tip just because we have already so many other things going on. I hope that's okay with you, Jacob.
Yeah, sure.
And I just want folks to know that today's episode of the Concealed Carry Podcast is brought to you by Guardian Nation. And so without any further ado, I think we will just move right along. But real quick, though, before we jump into our first news story, Jacob, we just got back from SHOT Show 2017. Just in a nutshell, what did you think?
Big.
Yeah.
How was that for a nutshell? Yeah. SHOT Show is just so big, you know? It goes to remind, you know, me each year, like, how huge this industry is. It's so much bigger than any one of us or any one company or any one section of the industry. Like, it's just so massive. We're part of something very large.
That's so true. I mean, that is definitely something that's impressed me every time I go. I remember my first time attending SHOT Show and just being really overwhelmed with, like, as you said, the size of the industry. And it's a pleasure to be a part of this industry. I was really impressed with a few of the newly, truly innovative products that are coming to market soon, which we'll probably talk some more on that later this week on the Wednesday episode, I suppose. We did talk a little bit last Wednesday about some of our first impressions of the show, but I hope maybe this Wednesday we can go a little bit deeper on a few other things and some things that we saw after we recorded that episode. And Jacob's audio might sound a little different today, folks. That's because Jacob does not have his usual microphone.
Yeah, Riley has it hostage.
We took our mics with us to the show. I drove, Jacob flew. But I had a funeral that suddenly popped up into the schedule here, and I had to, instead of driving home to Colorado, drive to Idaho to attend a funeral. So I've got all the mics with me, and my apologies for that. But anyway, let's jump into this. The first thing here is that this is actually a couple of weeks ago now. It actually was reported while we were at American Marksman. And this was the mass shooting that took place at the Fort Lauderdale Airport in Florida there. We hadn't talked about it yet on the podcast, so we thought we'd do that now. Jacob, what's the rundown and what's the latest, as far as you know, that we've heard on this?
Yeah, the short, you know, kind of order of events is our shooter, he takes a flight, you know, he lands in Fort Lauderdale, he retrieves his checked bags, goes into a bathroom, loads his Walther handgun, comes out of the restroom, starts shooting. I think a total of 11 people were hit, if I'm not mistaken, and of those, five have died. And so, you know, in short, the guy shoots until he runs out of ammo, and then he just sits there and waits to be arrested. Police arrive and take him into custody approximately a minute and a half after the first shot ran out.
Yeah. And my understanding is he basically fired his gun until he was out of rounds, like a full magazine, and then he essentially surrendered himself. Is that what you heard?
Yep, that's how I understand it, and that's what it says on the news article that someone wrote on our website for us.
Yeah, you can see this article at concealedcarry.com, and of course, as usual, the links will be in the show notes of today's episode. I believe, is it still that five people have passed away, been killed after this shooting?
Yeah, I think so. And we kind of have some information about the victims, and it's kind of really sad to kind of read through and learn more about those people. But yeah, I think the other six all made a recovery.
Mm. There was a video too that was released. It wasn't supposed to be released. TMZ got a hold of it. That I believe this video was recorded using someone's cell phone of the surveillance video directly, you know, on scene there at the airport, which was a big no-no. And have you seen that video by chance, Jacob?
No, but I'm Googling it now.
Yeah, I saw it and I watched it, and it really just shows the very beginning of the of this scene, of this incident occurring. And according, you know, just like it's written here in the articles, both the article we've published on our website as well as what I've seen elsewhere, he just sort of very calmly pulls his gun out of his waistband and proceeds to shoot while he's walking and or running. It's pretty, you know, it's hard to watch. You don't see anyone necessarily get shot or anything. You know, it's not, I wouldn't say it's gory or anything. It's just shocking to see this sort of thing happen in a place where people are completely unaware. They feel relatively safe and secure, but the reality is it was not a safe and secure place that day. And just so it's clear for the listeners, this was not in a secure area of the airport. This was basically near the baggage check claim. And, you know, folks are just going about their business, minding their own business, going about their day. You know, they've just arrived there. They're picking up or waiting for their bags. And the one thing that stood out to me is when he begins shooting, you do see a few people sort of react, and you definitely sense that some people's immediate reaction is run, get away, while others are almost just, they don't know, you know, they're not processing what's happening yet. They just sort of freeze. And I mean, this is so true of a lot of things. People are going to react a lot of different ways. Some people are going to freeze. Some people are going to immediately take flight. And now we don't have an example in this incident where someone, you know, fights back or anything like that. But that it shows kind of that whole spectrum of, you know, possible reactions that we see from people a lot of times in these sorts of events.
Yeah. It's just scary to think about. I mean, there's been a little bit of blood, of course, in the, from the gun grabbers about guns in airports, and should we allow people to check guns in their luggage and this kind of drama. I don't see it as really relevant. I mean, he could have just as easily had just walked into an airport somewhere. You know, the fact that he happened to transport it and has checked luggage legally, I don't see it as entirely relevant. But that's something that's inevitably going to be, you know, come to light, and people are going to start talking about. We do have an episode. I just looked it up. Episode 54, which we exclusively talk about air travel with a firearm.
Right. Yeah. Now, here's one thing that is quite apparent from this, it shares a common thread with many other mass shootings that we've seen over the years, and that is this shooter had mental health problems. He needed help. There were some people that knew he needed help. He was in the military. There were, I believe, those in the military that was aware of and knew that he needed help. And the big thing that saw a lot of reporting was how back in November, he walked into the FBI field office in Anchorage, Alaska, saying that he had problems, essentially. And they, you know, looked into him, they investigated him a little bit, but ultimately there was not anything that they could do. A few months, you know, 2 months later, basically, he's at an airport shooting the place up. What do you say to that about, you know, this is the whole mental health aspect of this?
Well, it's funny because, you know, we see this a lot, right? Like we saw this with the Orlando shooter. We've seen other things like this where, you know, these criminals, you know, were on a radar, were flagged at some point, and now it's like, oh, why didn't we do anything? You know, and in hindsight, it's really easy to point fingers and be like, what the crap? You're like, what? How did we not, you know, deal with this? When, you know, but the truth is, like, I suspect, maybe I'm wrong. Like, Riley, tell me if you think I'm out of line. Like, I'm totally open to that. But I suspect that things like that, someone walking into a field office, someone walking into an FBI field office and saying, I'm screwed up or I need help. I bet you that happens all the time. And it's very rare that one of those people actually commits a violent act like this. So it's really easy to kind of, in hindsight, point at someone like the FBI and say, you idiots, you morons, you know, why didn't you do something? But I suspect that, you know, if they took action on, you know, the kind of action we would have expected them to have taken on this individual, we wouldn't be comfortable with what they'd be doing to a lot of individuals.
Yeah. Well, I do think you're right in that regard, because, yeah, these sorts of things probably do happen often as far as people basically crying out for help, and yet they still don't go and commit mass shootings. But there definitely are some things mental health-wise that could be addressed. I would say number one, just sure. My own personal opinion. I feel like there probably could be more resources, you know, provided, whether from the government, whether from private sector, from nonprofits, etc. There are many options out there for treatment and for help, but it's clear to me that this is going to continue to be and remain a problem, and you know. We probably need to dedicate more resources for this sorts of thing.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that.
Yeah. Now let's. And I'm sorry to kind of start off today's episode with a story like that. That's not a fun way to start. But let's shift gears a little bit here and let's go to Nevada. Now we reported back in November how. The voters, they had a ballot initiative in Nevada, and it barely passed. I mean, by a slim margin, where the voters in Nevada approved this universal background check law, essentially. And this is now being challenged in the courts because, well, let me quote here. This is from our article on our NevadaFirearmTraining.com website. It says, the lawsuit filed Thursday by a private gun seller adds a new issue to the law, arguing that it improperly creates a taxable event for gun sellers in violation of the state constitution. It also says that it would violate the seller's right to due process in the event that they did not have the checks conducted. So the issue here is that this universal background check, what people mean when they say universal is that it applies both to private and dealer sales and transfers of other types. And the concern is that the background check costs money, essentially. And the financial burden for the background check, but also there's a tax that's, I'll continue quoting here so I explain it better. A retailer performing a background check for a private gun sale or transfer would have to take possession of the firearm as if it was part of the store's inventory and then charge the seller a sales or use tax. So what they're basically saying is in Nevada, when you want to do a private party sale, you'd have to go to a dealer to have them do the background check. But the dealer would have to take possession of that firearm as part of that transaction. And then when that's turned over to the purchaser, and then the seller of that firearm is charged a sales or use tax. So just to sell a gun, apparently, and this is really strange, and I don't remember hearing about any sort of issues like this when we were first reported on this Nevada universal background check, but this just sounds crazy to me, Jacob. Like I'm not wrapping my head around it. Maybe you've got a little bit more insight.
There's a couple of issues here. The other one you know, other than the tax issue, and this is probably the more relevant one, is that the law, the way it was worded, the new law that was passed and voted in, it stated that dealers conducting background checks for private transfers must contact the FBI's National Instant Criminal Background Check System, NICS, to determine if the buyer is eligible to purchase or possess the firearm. Now, the problem is that a state law was written requiring that the dealer had to use a federal resource. And so you have two problems here. You have the Nevada Attorney General, who's come out and basically said, this won't work. Like, the way the law is worded, it won't work because of the tax issue. And then you have the FBI, who contacted the Nevada Department of Public Safety on December 14th and said that they will not conduct those background checks. It basically said the recent passage of Nevada legislation regarding background checks for private sales cannot dictate how federal resources are applied. So you have a law that, because it was poorly worded, poorly written, and probably the people who put it together don't really understand how the system works, it's now unenforceable. And so the law is on the books, but both the Nevada Attorney General and the FBI have basically said, forget it.
Yeah. Interesting. So obviously, we got to let this kind of run its course a little bit, and we'll see what happens. But as I mentioned towards the beginning here, this passed by a very narrow margin. And so it's clear to me that you've got basically half of the state, and probably actually a little bit more sometimes, because there's definitely a little bit of a silent majority, I think, effect to things of this nature. But you've basically got half the state that's pissed off, sorry for lack of a better word, at this law. And the other half that, you know, there's some that are definitely going to be very passionate about it. But there's also probably some people amongst those that voted for it that just thought, oh, that sounds like a good idea. You know, well, that probably is not that big of a deal. But in reality, when it comes to enforcing the law, we find out that it's actually quite messy. And it really, at the center of this, these types of laws are quite unenforceable, as we are finding in places like Colorado, where we've passed similar laws.
Yep, and that's been true virtually everywhere. I mean, remember the SAFE Act debacle in New York? I mean, every time, you know, legislatures, they slam this stuff through because it makes them feel warm and fuzzy, but they don't stop to think, is this actually practical? Like, can we actually do this?
Yeah. Yep. Well, speaking of various guns and laws and government and whatever, one of the federal agencies that attempt to keep us safe as we fly in the skies is TSA. And we're probably all familiar with reports where the TSA misses things that pass through security checks. But speaking of those that are caught during security checks, TSA reports that I think it was on average 9 firearms per day were discovered in carry-on bags in the year 2016.
Wow,
that's really interesting. And this is the highest we've ever seen it too.
Yeah, correct. So, and it's kind of cool to look at the chart. If you guys follow the link that's in the show notes through and look at the little chart that the TSA put out, I'd call it an infographic, nice little graphic. There's a couple of charts on here, but it shows kind of a 10-year span in a bar graph, and it's just straight up. It's just going straight up. Like in 2005, the TSA took 660 guns, okay? 2006, 821, then 803, 926, 976, 1123. It just keeps going up and up and up and up and up. In the year prior, 2015, the TSA set a record at 2,653 firearms. Now, this last year, 2016, 3,391 firearms. So not only is it the highest year ever, but the growth is getting higher. Like the growth curve is crazy at this point. It's just unbelievable. So yeah, 3,391 over 365 days. That's an average of 9 per day.
So here's my take on this, and I've spent the weekend actually thinking on this a little bit, Jacob, because we talked about this. I think you showed me this infographic last week for the first time while we were at SHOT Show, and I've been kind of thinking about it since then, because I was really intrigued with the growth in the statistics here of number of firearms found at airports. And the more I think about it, the more I am becoming convinced that there's a direct correlation to the number of people that are carrying concealed. Because I think this chart looks probably pretty similar Although we don't necessarily have anything quite like this from on a nationwide basis, showing the national statistics for, number of people carrying concealed or having permits or whatever. But I suspect, based on what we've seen as a trend in the industry, based on what we've seen as instructors and in our business, I suspect that this is very closely related to the number of people obtaining concealed handgun permits and carrying their guns concealed. Do you agree or disagree with that?
Oh, I think there's definitely correlation. I don't know if there's causation. Further down in our own article on our website, our writer here, he inserted another graph that shows gun transactions based on the NICS system over the last 15 years. And that chart definitely correlates with the chart that shows number of firearms seized at airports. So another argument could be made that it correlates just with gun ownership or gun transactions, but also with concealed carry would make sense, right? And if you kind of read through the blog post on the TSA website where they kind of announce this data, and they do it every year. Every year I read this and I always find it fascinating. But they always say the same thing, and that is that the vast majority of these cases, it's an accident. The person forgets it's there, right? The gun is just in the bag, then they show up and, I left that in my bag, dang it, kind of thing. And they said that that's just by far and away the majority of the instances. And so, I think that if someone has a gun in a bag and 83% of the time it's loaded, according to the TSA, odds are pretty high that they're concealed carry permit holders. I think the other thing that, what might be worth noting here is that air travel is increasing. There's probably also a correlation here with just general air travel. How often people travel by plane versus other methods of transportation is also dramatically increasing at a similar rate. So I think it's a combination. Are there more guns? Yes. Are there more permits? Yes. Are more people flying than they were driving, years ago? Yeah, by far, right? So I think all those things just, naturally it's going to go up. It would be interesting if the TSA would give us a statistics of like per capita, like for every 1,000 travelers, what percentage are do we take a gun? We might find in that case that it's actually flat year over year. It's just that, more people fly than they used to. I don't know.
Yeah. Correlation versus causation, whatever, that's fine. I really think, why are people forgetting they've got guns in their bags? Well, they're forgetting they have guns in their bags because they're carrying their guns around with them. And people are doing this at a rate that is greater than ever before seen, at this time in history. On that subject, by the way, and we talked about this in a previous podcast episode to great extent. Jacob, you would know which episode that was, but I think the tip that I've given before, and maybe this is the so-called training tip for today. Let's just call it the tip of the day today, where I would strongly suggest that you never fly with bags that you frequently carry guns or ammunition in. I've got a backpack that sometimes has spare mags in it. Sometimes, occasionally, has had a gun in it. I never fly with that backpack. because I just know that there's going to be a loose round hanging out in there or a whole mag. I mean, like the risk is too great. So, don't fly with your bags that you frequently carry guns in. It would be kind of my tip.
I think there's a couple of parts of that too. Not only like, okay, sometimes I have guns in these bags, so I should not use them for air travel. But the other side of this is, why the crap do you have guns in a bag? Like at all. Like I'm trying to, because I take it to the range. Well, when you go to the range, shouldn't you use, like you already said, you should have a range bag. That bag should be designated. But those guns should be, probably in a locked container that shouldn't get left in that bag. When you get back from the range, don't you put those back in a gun safe? Like my other issue with this whole story is that it's just generally a bad practice to have a gun in a bag, regardless of if I'm at the airport or not. Like a gun should at any given time be on my body or in a safe locked up. So why do we have guns in a bag at all?
Yeah, but and I agree with you, and we've talked about that before as well. But the fact is, people are going to carry guns in bags, but we would strongly discourage you from doing so. I'm assuming a lot of these is a purse, a backpack, a laptop bag, a briefcase. These are the sorts of things that people are carrying onto the plane. And these are the types of bags that they are finding guns in when they're going through security. If the if you're carrying guns in those, it's probably because you're carrying it in those bags for self-defense. That is the less preferable method than just having it right immediately on your person, as Jacob just pointed out. But, you know, I've done it. Jacob, you've carried a gun in a bag, I'm sure, at some point as well. So we all do it at some point. We just got to use some common sense. Preferably don't use the bag that you use to go to the range or whatever, or transporting firearms. Don't go to the airport with it. And at least if you do, I don't know, do a really good job searching it over. But I don't trust myself well enough to make sure that I don't leave some little 22 round in the bottom of some hidden corner of my backpack. And I know that's going to happen to me if I ever go with my my favorite backpack. Yeah, it doesn't go on the plane with me. It's not a good idea. All righty, let's get on to four states look to pass constitutional carry in 2017. Also, a story reported on our website, concealedcarry.com. And we've got four states. It looks like New Hampshire, North Dakota, New Mexico, and Kentucky, all considering a permitless carry type model.
Well, and there's two that we missed when we wrote this article, two other states that I was not aware of at the time when we assigned this task. And that would be Texas and Indiana. So Texas and Indiana also now have bills, you know, that have been brought forth for constitutional carry. So total six that we know of at this point.
Wow. And now, if these were able to pass through, then they would join states such as Alaska, Arizona, Arkansas, Idaho, Kansas, Maine, Mississippi, Missouri, Vermont, West Virginia, and Wyoming that also have constitutional carry laws. Now, the typical way that this happens for many of these states is they still maintain their concealed carry permits and have a solution as far as that's concerned. So you still have the ability to get a permit, which we would certainly advise, because with that, then you get reciprocity and you can carry in other states. But are any of these states, Jacob, are they looking at doing something where they abolish their permit system and they go strictly to just constitutional carry, like Vermont that doesn't issue permits?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm trying to remember. I thought that when you and I read the bill for, I don't see Florida on this list. Didn't we report that Florida had a bill forth like that? I have to go double check that. But I think Texas is the one I remember. Texas, the bill that was originally proposed, and remember that they're constantly changing these bills, and you might have two different versions of the bill, one that goes in the Senate, one that goes in the House. And so, you know, you can't always quote us on these things because they're constantly tweaking this before they hit a vote. But the original bill that was put forth in Texas, and I think we did cover this in the podcast, it proposed eliminating the permit system altogether, which I'm confident had no hope of passing. So I'm sure that that's probably since been amended or will be amended before, you know, it hits a vote.
Now, actually scanning through things here, I was reminded that in New Mexico, this is the way I read it, Jacob. It does say here that Senator Stephen Neville also plans to introduce permitless carry legislation in the capital of Santa Fe to deregulate the carry process in the land of enchantment. So that seems to indicate that, I mean, I read that as deregulate the carry process, meaning get rid of it, you know, and make the law so that anyone who is legally able to own the firearm would be able to carry said firearm, concealed or otherwise, in New Mexico. So I don't, you know, we'd have to dig a little bit more on that, but
I don't read that in such a way that suggests that it's to abolish the permit system altogether. In fact, I think it's, in my opinion, I think it's the opposite, because right now getting rid of permits would be really unpopular given the Trump legislation of national reciprocity. So, you know, this would be, in fact, I suspect if the National Reciprocity Act bill, whatever we're calling it, if that's passed, Vermont will start, you know, issuing permits. Because this, it'd be a really bad time for that, given that, you know, you have to have a permit in order to get reciprocity. And now if that bill passes, you know, you have reciprocity in all 50 states. So I don't know. I find it highly unlikely that they would abolish the permit system altogether, given the current climate.
It is very clear to me in North Dakota that it says right here that they would still be able to get their permits, even if permitless carry passed. As would Kentucky. All right. speaking of National Reciprocity, our next news story reported, this is a story on our CaliforniaGunTraining.com website, and it's actually more geared towards Californians, but this would apply to any American. If National Reciprocity was passed, there's a lot of really great things that would happen for gun owners across America. So being reported on our CaliforniaGunTraining.com website, it says here that Representative Richard Hudson of North Carolina, he recently brought forth a bill that would mean that Californians would soon have an easy path. Now, it's referring to Representative Hudson of North Carolina. He's brought up this legislation in the House of Representatives at the national level, okay? And once again, this was written on our California site. But says that Californians would soon have an easy path to a concealed carry license, ending a longstanding hurdle for most interested in self-defense carrying. As we know, in California, there's, what, 5 or 6 counties, Jacob, where it's reasonably, you know, it's doable as far as getting a permit. But almost the rest of the state is dang near impossible.
Right, right. And so the idea here is that some people, when they saw this national reciprocity bill come forward, they were thinking to themselves, well, that's great for people who can get a permit, but I live in New York City or I live in LA County in California. And so, you know, it won't help me because I can't get a permit, at least not a resident permit. And so essentially someone asked Hudson, they said, hey, you know, this bill, the way you've written it, would it also apply to non-resident permits? Meaning that if I am a resident of a county in California or New York City or one of these, Maryland, and I cannot get a permit, New Jersey, if I were to go get a non-resident permit from, say, Arizona or Utah or Florida or Virginia, one of these states where, you know, they'll give a permit to anybody no matter where they live, does that mean I now have national reciprocity? I can carry anywhere, even though my local jurisdiction issuing authority wouldn't give me a permit? And Hudson clarified that. It quotes him. It says, my legislative intent is to ensure a non-resident carry permit is recognized. And I've confirmed this with legislative counsel and judiciary committee staff.
That is so interesting and also very hopeful for people in these, I'm just going to refer to them as communistic type states, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's really refreshing to hear. I mean, we've been on record as having stated we would be really surprised if this national reciprocity bill were to pass. And even if it did pass, we would be surprised if there weren't lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit from these various states like California and New York and so forth, New Jersey, you know, basically calling this an infringement on states' rights. But I'm going to remain hopeful, and we'll see how things play out. We know this is being proposed in the House of Representatives. We know that if it were to actually pass through the House and pass through the Senate, I believe President Trump would sign it. But I think it's a long road to get to that point, even, you know, before it gets to the president's desk.
Yeah, and we've talked about this before, and we've talked about all the kind of barriers that exist to prevent this from becoming reality. Well, beyond just the legal, you know, get it past barriers. That was episode 69, if you want to kind of hear Ryan and I's, you know, deeper thoughts about, you know, national reciprocity and what it would really take.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll see what happens. And by the way, can I just say how good it feels to say President Trump?
Hey, that's
as opposed
deal.
To President Clinton.
Yeah, yeah. Trump Day.
Our news would be very different right now, I think, if it was President Clinton. Because we know exactly where she stood on some of these gun, you know, Second Amendment issues. But anyway, here's some really interesting. I think this is fantastic news, by the way. So it puts a smile on my face. I know it doesn't for some people, but of course, I think it would have put a smile on my face regardless of which gun was selected. But the fact is that the U.S. Army has a new sidearm, and the sidearm of choice, it has been announced at the SIG P320, and it's actually a variant of the standard P320 you buy in the stores. For instance, it has a manual safety. It has, they come with kind of an MOS type configuration. So there's a little piece on the slide that you can pop off and you can stick a red dot on them if need be. It's basically a P320, but with a few additional tweaks to it. The manual safeties and the slide lock are both ambidextrous, so they're on both sides of the gun. It's modular, so they can, you know, swap out the grip for smaller grip, larger grip, regular or medium-sized grip. That was the whole intent here for this procurement process by the U.S. Army to replace the Beretta M9 handgun, was they wanted something a little bit more modular and more up-to-date and more reliable. There were some problems with reliability with the old M9. I know there's people who debate me on that fact, because I know some guys say that they've been, you know, great guns. But the fact is, 26% of U.S. Army personnel that actually had used M9 Berettas in the field reported that they were unreliable or that they had experienced malfunctions.
That's a lot.
The test, yes, it is. And the testing process, by the way, because I've heard people say, well, the P320 is not reliable. Well, from what I've seen from it, seems to be a pretty reliable gun. And I'll tell you, the U.S. Army's testing process, they were looking at, by the way, the Glock, Glock 17 and Glock 19 were both submitted to in this procurement competition. SIG or Smith & Wesson's M&P, FN's 5.7 pistol was submitted. Let's see. I know I'm missing one.
There's a CZ. The P09.
That's right. So a number of guns were submitted for consideration by the U.S. Army. And ultimately, the P320 won out. And I know going through that process, all of these guns were fired thousands and thousands and thousands of rounds, and reliability was a big factor here. So if the P320 didn't prove to be reliable, it would not have won. It was announced in December that the Glock and the SIG P320 were the finalists, and then it was just announced a few days ago, while we were at SHOT Show, actually, that the P320 was the winner. So, pretty interesting news. What do you think, Jacob?
I say congratulations to Sig Sauer is what I think. The Army is welcome to make whatever decision they want. Some people, I saw some comments that people are a little frustrated because the Sig Sauer is not an American company, but I mean, that's debatable. The guns are certainly made in the U.S. There are a lot of American jobs here. And so ultimately, I think, we want our soldiers to pack the best gun they can into combat. And if they think this is the best gun, I say props to Sig Sauer, and I like that gun.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I have seen also some comments about, they should have picked an American gun company. You know what? I kind of understand that sentiment, but I also have to say, I want the best tool in the hands of our men and women that are out there defending our country. And if this is what they determined was the best tool, then that's what we should go with. These P320s. In fact, the P320, I don't think has ever been made not in America. They might be making some in Europe, but I know all the ones that we buy and use here in the U.S. are made in New Hampshire. That would be the same also for Glock. Glock is making handguns right here in the U.S. And yes, Jacob, as you mentioned, those are American jobs. Those are American workers. These companies have huge presences here in the U.S. They support a ton of the U.S. economy, right here in the U.S. So I don't have a problem with the gun. I don't have a problem with it being Sig Sauer. You and I have had some quite a bit of recent experience with the P320, and we find it to be a very nice handgun.
Yeah.
So, pretty fun. And by the way, this new handgun is going to the P320, you as used by the U.S. Army, is going to be known as the M17. So replacing the M9. Cool stuff. Let's jump now, Jacob, to I'd like to start with this San Antonio Mall shooting. So a little bit out of the order that we have on the current outline. This was just reported. Well, I just found out about it this morning, but I believe it happened yesterday. In San Antonio, there was a Kay's jewelry store robbed. A number of suspects Let's see. It talks about two suspects. I had seen another story about three or four, but we definitely know that there were two involved, at least as far as the shooting's concerned. So two suspects, at least, enter the K Jewelers store in the Rolling Oaks Mall in San Antonio. They robbed the jewelry store armed. They've both got handguns. As they are leaving, two Good Samaritans attempt to intervene. One of those Good Samaritans, his name was Jonathan Murphy. He, age 42, he was shot and killed by one of these two suspects. The other Good Samaritan draws and fires his weapon, wounding one of the suspects. The other suspect then ran away, and while running through the mall, fired at people randomly. So I believe total we have four people that are wounded. That includes one of the suspects and a couple of people in the mall. One additional victim, which was one of the two Good Samaritans, was killed. The other suspect was eventually captured and taken into custody. And of course, they will both be facing charges for murder and along with a whole other host of charges. This is a very complex story, Jacob. What's your take on it? What do you get out of this?
Well, I'm trying to decide what to say first without sounding insensitive. The truth is, my first gut feeling was, how did the Good Samaritan get killed? I mean, that was my first thought, was like, oh, like, we got somebody here who's trying to take good action and didn't work out for them. Like, did they not have enough training? Did they make a bad decision? Like, I'm immediately putting myself in those shoes and asking myself, you know, what went wrong here? Because we read so many stories, right? We talk about so many stories where the good guy prevails. And so when we're confronted with the stories where the good guy fails, it hurts a little bit.
Yeah, it's true. It is a little bit too early for us to really know all the details as to what happened here. So we don't know exactly how it played out and exactly why one of these two Good Samaritans was shot and killed. But we do. Here's what I appreciate about this story, and yeah, this is not a feel good story. But I'm sharing it here in this Justified segment here today. I mean, one, we know that one of these Good Samaritans that shoots and wounds one of these suspects, as far as I could tell, based on the limited information we have, he's completely justified in him doing that. But the reality is, in these sorts of situations, just because you have a gun and just because maybe even you have some training does not guarantee that you are not going to get wounded or even killed. And that's what I appreciate about this story, is that it's a reminder for you and for I and for all of our listeners of this podcast that this stuff is real. And we've got to make sure we always keep things in perspective as far as that's concerned. Because I see an alarming, trend, or trend's not even necessarily quite the word I mean, but I sometimes see comments and discussions amongst people about how, oh, I'm good. I got my gun. I'm good. You know, like, everything's cool. You know, I'm taken care of if I'm in a situation where I need my gun. No, it's far from that. That is far from the truth. The reality is that just because you have that gun and just because you have some minimal amount of training does not mean that you won't end up like poor Jonathan Murphy, age 42, of San Antonio, Texas, who is now dead.
Yeah. Another thought, and again, you know, we play armchair quarterback on this podcast, sometimes fruitlessly and sometimes in a way that's slightly insensitive, but we do it in an attempt to learn and try and, you know, not make mistakes in the future. Whether these were really mistakes in the moment or not, we don't really know. But as I understand the story, you have two men who rob a jewelry store, and as they're leaving, as they're escaping, I've seen in some of the news reports, that the two Good Samaritans intervene. And right. this would be like the other big like takeaway for me. And again, I realize it sounds a little insensitive given that we have a dead man, but Is that an appropriate place to insert yourself with the firearm into a situation when the crime has already been committed, no one's been hurt, and now these two guys just are looking for an exit with the money or cash or jewelry or whatever it is that they've obtained? And now when you insert yourself into that situation, are you really, saving lives? Are you really, protecting innocent at that point? Or are you merely protecting jewelry or cash and trying to affect justice on a criminal? So that would be my other, and who knows what situation, they might have just seen two guys with guns running toward them. Like I who am I to judge, right? But I would say that
Right.
we should be thinking about, our objective is to protect life, not to prevent someone's escape. And that's really what this, should be about.
Yeah. And those are fair points. And that's also a train of thought that I was, pondering on when I first heard the story. It was kind of like, okay, you know what? Stuff is just stuff, you know? So these guys got some jewelry. So what? That jewelry store probably and hopefully has insurance. And I would expect that they do. I mean, jewelry stores probably to some degree should expect at some point to get robbed.
Yeah, and
So,
this is a national chain. I mean, it's a big company.
yeah, exactly. It's K Jewelers. So, stuff. Let them go. Let them, take the stuff. Fine. Great. All right. Be done with it. There's no need to interject violence if these guys aren't going to use violence. But the problem is when you confront them and you've now cornered them, it's just like cornering a wild animal. That animal's going to fight back. It's going to fight to try to get away. It's like the story in Colorado Springs, Jacob, where not too long ago, I think it was in December, where these guys robbed a store. I think it was a Sears or something, and the asset protection, security dude kind of tried to, I think, stop him or whatever, but they ended up just sh oh no, that's what it was. They locked the doors. The store basically had closed, the doors were locked. So as these guys were trying to escape, suddenly they're faced with no means of escaping. So they shot their way through the door, through the glass, so they could get away. But I think you also said it too, Jacob. We don't know all the details, and you may be very much right in this, in that they just see two guys coming their direction with guns in hand. You don't know what's
Yeah,
going to happen.
we don't know. That's right.
You
That's
don't
right.
know that they're not going to just shoot you just because you happen to be in the wrong place, wrong time. So, we can't judge in this regard. But as you explained, it's good for us, I think, as an exercise from an educational standpoint to think through these types of scenarios and think what would the best course of action be. And I would say if you felt like, based on your gut, based on your experience, whatever, if you felt like these guys were just going to escape and that they didn't necessarily mean to cause any harm to anybody, let them escape. But if you did feel like your life might be in jeopardy because they are armed and they are acting aggressively or threatening, well, then decide what you got to do. But understand that the consequence might cost you your life. And that's the truth of just about any one of these justified stories that we've ever shared on this podcast. It always has the potential for the participants to end up themselves also losing their life. So that's the reality. I wanted to make sure that we remind folks of that. Now let's go to some stories where folks are a little bit more successful. In Cobb County, Georgia, and this was well reported. In fact, I remember seeing this video floating about. I think on Facebook, I saw it a couple of different places. Georgia gun store robbery averted by well-armed gun store owner. So in Cobb County, Georgia, gun store owner Jimmy Groover was forced to shoot and kill an assailant in an attempted robbery of his store. The incident happened at around 11 a.m. on Monday morning. This was like a week. I was going to say this was last week, so I think this was last Monday, a week ago from today. The gun store is Dixie Gun and Pawn on Veterans Memorial Highway. The owner, Jimmy Groover, and another employee were in the store with two customers when two masked men came inside. "Get down on the floor. Get down on the floor or I'll kill you," Groover recalled the suspects telling him. "Then they shot at me." What the men weren't aware of was that Groover had a gun of his own. I chuckle at that, Jacob, because what gun store have you ever been in where the gun store employee or owner did not wear a gun on their hip?
Yeah. Yeah, they're obviously not listening to our podcast, I can tell you that. But yeah, it's true. If you sell guns, you're packing.
So feeling like his life was on the line, he pulled the trigger, shooting and killing one of the suspects. The other is still on the run.
Well, it's noteworthy that he was fired on first. The first shots fired were from the suspects.
Yeah, yeah, that's what he says here. And interestingly enough, he says this is not the first time his gun and pawn shop has been burglarized. In fact, it's happened about 20 times. Holy cow. Groover has added security cameras, bars on the windows, and keeps all guns and safes at night in efforts to thwart would-be criminals. One thing that was a shock, I think, to everybody involved was that this happened in broad daylight. It happened, and this guy was prepared to respond. Now, one thing that's also, I think, noteworthy, Jacob, is how the gun store owner, Jimmy Groover, responded. When asked about it, he said, "I hate it. I really do. I hate it. I hate it bad," referring to him having to fire and take the life of one of these burglary suspects.
Yep. I had no other choice. I hate that it happened.
Yep. Anyway, I'll see if I can find a link in included in the show notes of this episode to the surveillance video where you actually see this play out. It's quite short. It happens very fast, but that's also the reality of these sorts of things. They happen quickly. This guy responded very well considering how quickly and how stressful it must have been, you know, when this happened. All right, Jacob, let's get to our final justified story. This is one I've been excited to talk about since I first heard about it, which was a couple weeks ago now. But it kind of happened in the middle of that whole, we were getting ready to leave for SHOT Show, and there was, yeah, a lot of crazy stuff going on. Last week, we had Gary Quisenberry for our Monday episode of the podcast. We talked about SHOT Show in the Wednesday episode. And folks, by the way, many of you missed out on last Thursday evening where we had Gary Quisenberry as our live broadcast guest, and it was a wonderful time. But anyway, since I heard about this story, I've been waiting for our next regular news episode, Jacob, to talk about, because I just think this one's fantastic. Out of Arizona, and as reported on concealedcarry.com, Arizona State Trooper's life was saved by a concealed carrier. So in Tonopah, about 50 miles west of Phoenix, this was, I think, two Thursdays ago, and it was in the morning, about 4 a.m. on the westbound side of Interstate 10. According to the Arizona Department of Public Safety, a citizen called to report that their vehicle was being shot at from the median near milepost 81 on I-10. By the way, it's noteworthy to me, Jacob, that in the last year or so, there has been a bunch of random people shot at in their vehicles I think, the Phoenix area. So I read that and I instantly thought, okay, was this maybe the guy that was doing that, you know? And maybe now that's going to be brought to an end because of this story. But anyway, let me continue. A trooper that was in the area had just left another traffic stop to investigate the call when he came upon a rollover crash near milepost 89. He saw a woman there who had been ejected from the crash and began working to block lanes. At that time, according to the Arizona DPS, the trooper was ambushed by a suspect who came from an unknown direction. The suspect shot the trooper at least once in the chest shoulder area and fought the trooper to the ground. Two passersby then stopped to render aid, and the trooper shouted for help. Officials say it was at that point one man went back to his car, grabbed a gun, and shot at the suspect who was not following his commands to stop attacking the trooper. The suspect was killed at the scene. A second man helped stabilize the trooper and asked where his radio was to call for help. And you can hear the recording of that, some of the radio traffic from this incident is really fascinating to listen to. So that's basically the story there. And once again, I kind of can't help but wonder if this guy that ambushed this trooper was maybe related to some of these random shooting incidents that we've had over the last year or two. The other thing is the trooper sees this rolled over car. You know, I just had, my brain is like wanting to explode with all the possibilities and speculation here. It's like, did this suspect maybe shoot a tire out or something on this car and that caused her to wreck and roll over? And it started this whole chain reaction of events where he wanted to, you know, attack this trooper. I don't know. We don't have the details on a lot of things yet. We may not even know everything because the suspect is dead. But this is so remarkable to me that we have everyday Joe citizens stopping to help troopers out, which this very same, it played out almost the same way where we just saw this sort of thing happen in Florida just a couple of weeks or a month or so ago.
Yeah, very comparable.
Yeah, it's...
Stop and think about this. I mean, we're... the officer is in significant peril, right? I mean, he's been shot. He's in a battle that he's losing. The trooper's on the ground, right? He's shouting for help. These are the circumstances in which we put our officers. And I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm simply saying it's reality that sometimes they're out and about and unexpected, they're ambushed. And there's not much we can do about preventing those situations, but the good guy with the gun prevails. You know, once again, it simply comes down to good people with the right tools in the right time and the right moment are able to save lives. I mean, this is an officer. This guy has put his life on the line every day out there, no matter how you want to think of that. And you know, he didn't get up this morning and think, oh, I'm going to get shot at and tackled today, and thank goodness someone else is going to shoot the bad guy. But that's how it went down. And yeah, twice within like 30, 60 days in this country.
Something right.
Very similar.
I just think it's so noble of people like this to be willing and able to step in to save these officers' lives. Because just like we talked a few minutes ago about the Good Samaritan that tried to do, I guess, the right thing, but it ended up costing him his life. These two guys that stopped in to help this trooper both put their own lives in a great deal of they put their lives at a great deal of risk. They could very easily have lost their lives in this type of event as well, just like that man down in Florida did as well. So this is just remarkable to me. You know, we think so often in terms of I carry my gun to defend myself, and that is really the primary purpose, as it should be, I think, for most people. It is definitely, I think you should take care as far as in injecting yourself into third, you know, as the third party into other people's problems, because you don't necessarily always know the situation. You don't always know what's going on. But these sorts of situations, I think, are unique in that you see a law enforcement officer, you know, or at least, I mean, it would, yeah, you see a law enforcement officer, he needs help. You kind of know what's going on there. You don't need to ask too many questions. It's kind of the way I feel, Jacob. As far as that officer's about to get killed, if I don't step in, it's pretty obvious how this might end up. So, after I heard about that Florida incident, I'll tell you, I mean, generally, I paid a lot of attention to law enforcement officers stopped on the side of the road anyway, because of my own personal background. But I have been paying a great deal more attention to these guys as I am going by, you know, traffic stops and things, making sure I'm looking out for them. I'm watching for them to make sure that they are, that they're not in distress. You know what I mean? And would I stop to help them if I could? Yeah, I would. Because they're out there putting their lives on the line every day for you and I. And I think it's important that citizens have their backs.
Yeah, no, great summary.
So, fantastic story. I'm sure we'll get some more details on this. Is it all, you know, there's still investigations taking place on, I think, all of these stories that we've just shared today. So as more details come to light, if they are relevant and if we feel they're newsworthy, we'll be certain to talk about them again. But that kind of wraps up our episode for today. It's It's been good to connect with you, Jacob, on a, you know, regular news format episode that we haven't been able to do in quite some time with all the craziness going on. But today's episode is brought to you by Guardian Nation. Guardian Nation is the community for devoted gun people focused on guarding themselves, their families, homes, and communities. We hope that you'll check it out and consider joining. Whether it be for the monthly training and drill videos, discounts on products in our store, the monthly Guardian Nation live broadcasts with top industry professionals, or the quarterly box of hand-picked Guardian gear, which we're getting very close to now shipping our first box to our current Guardian Nation members, at least those that signed up in time to qualify for this quarterly box. There's something for everyone in becoming a member of Guardian Nation, and we hope that you'll take a moment and check it out at guardiannation.com. And as I kind of alluded to earlier in the episode, this Wednesday, I think we're going to spend a good deal of time just talking about some of the other really cool stuff we saw at SHOT Show, our takeaways from that, some really cool new gear and guns that have been announced and coming out hopefully soon. And also we might even touch a little bit about on what some of our plans are upcoming here in the near future here at concealedcarry.com. A lot of really great stuff. Jacob, am I missing anything in today's episode?
Nope, I think that's a wrap.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I've been a little bit distracted here today. I'm still sitting here in Idaho, of course, looking outside the window at the snow coming down. And unfortunately, the forecast just doesn't look any better tomorrow. So I think we're gonna bear it and do the best we can, Jacob, and get on the road and see how far we can make it. Hopefully, I'll make it to Denver sometime tomorrow.
There you go. I'll cross my fingers for you.
So, folks, we'll catch you on the Wednesday episode of the Concealed Carry Podcast. Thank you so much for your support. We're really looking forward to bringing to you more great quality content. Check out, by the way, our YouTube channel. You can search Concealed Carry on YouTube and find our YouTube channel where we've already released 8 or 9 videos, I think, Jacob. Is that right?
Yeah, several. That's ballpark. We got another, 20 to go?
We got a bunch. A lot of really great content coming to you from our recent visit to SHOT Show 2017. So go check that out. A couple things that just off the top of my head I might mention that folks might find interest in. The new Hudson H9 9mm pistol, which is not like anything you've ever seen before. Just a really amazing, clever design. Also, some of the new pistol offerings from SIG. I really feel like SIG is just nailing it, just hitting it out of the park with a lot of what's coming out of SIG. Just really great stuff. And what's one video that you would recommend folks go check out right now, Jacob?
Oh, I really like the Control eyewear. I think that's pretty, industry revolutionary. I also think the Crimson Trace Link system, which is not super new, but we were reporting on that. I think that's noteworthy.
Yeah, we got that video published as well. So go check out the Crimson Trace Link. That's LINQ video on our YouTube channel. So anyway, just wanted to throw that out there as the last mention here before I sign off for the podcast. Go check out, subscribe to our YouTube channel to catch all of that really great video content from SHOT Show if you're looking to see the latest and greatest in the industry. So with that, I'm going to bid you all farewell. I'm going to hit the road. I hope to travel safely. Hope to see you all on the other side on our Wednesday episode of the podcast. Take care, Jacob, and listeners, we'll see you later.
A reminder that laws vary from place to place, and we encourage listeners to seek local legal advice to understand applicable laws. USA Firearm Training and the Concealed Carry Podcast strive to share insights and stories about firearm-related incidents and laws, but things could be different where you live, or laws may have changed by the time you listen to this. We cannot be held liable for your actions based on the information shared in the podcast.